Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Recorded live from the lobby of the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Junctional Thinking, the podcast, broadcasting live from the lobby of the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Pierre Vigilance, and thank you for joining me. This journey that we've been going through with Junctional Thinking is one that is inspired by the notion that in order to be effective at doing complex problem solving, especially in the health and human services or social impact spaces, one has to be nimble and effective at the intersection of a number of different inputs. So it's not just a linear, single lane space that you're going to be able to stay in and solve problems effectively. You have to be open to taking diverse inputs from different people, different sectors, and different spaces in order to be able to solve problems most effectively. And that means that you have to be open to speaking to people from different places and sectors and engaging with them on a regular basis. And we're really fortunate to be able to have a network that allows for that sort of interaction. And over the course of this last year, you've been hearing from guests from a number of different places and sectors: finance, education, housing, technology, government, just to name a few. And I'm really fortunate and happy today to be welcoming a friend of mine. We were just reminiscing about how long it's been that we've known each other, Jeff Reed, who is the founding director of the Georgetown Entrepreneurship Initiative at Georgetown University and a professor of the practice up there at the McDonough School. Also another member of the Leadership Greater Washington class of 2010, along with a couple of the other guests that you've heard from, Glenn Ogle and Mady Henson, to name just two. Thank you very much for coming in and agreeing to have this conversation with us about junctional thinking.
Pierre, it's great to be here. Great to see you. Look forward to the conversation.
Likewise. This is we've had a few conversations over the years, and I didn't realize that the entrepreneurship initiative at Georgetown is 10, just turned 10, I guess, last year.
Yeah.
And you're the founding director of that. But before we get into that particular part of things, you sort of tell us a little bit about the not so straight line that you've taken to get to this particular point.
Well, sure. I can give you the really long version, but I'll start off with
the
shorter.
As long as you are tall, then we'll be here till this afternoon, late this afternoon.
So yeah, my first love has always been education. You know, I grew up in a family of educators. And I saw the power of education to make a difference in people's world, help people live the life that they love. So that was my first thought. Then when I was in college, I learned about entrepreneurship, took a class, met some entrepreneurs, kind of thought that was cool too. And I was trying to figure out a way to combine those two things. And fortunately, early in my career, I got a chance to start the Entrepreneurship Center at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And when I founded that program, I really had no idea what I was getting into, but it's turned into a great career. Now, I led that program for 8 years, then left and decided I was out of academia for a long time.
Right.
When you talk about the winding path, this is where
right.
it starts to wind.
For sure.
You know, I worked at a law firm recruiting entrepreneurial clients. One of the companies, the startups I tried to recruit as a client, turned around and recruited me. So I joined a startup team.
Ah, okay.
Worked in a startup for almost 2 years. And that was a wild ride with some great success and then not so much success. When that ended for me, I thought, what am I going to do with my life? One of my former students said, hey, you should go back to teaching. I took over the role leading a nonprofit teaching entrepreneurship to young people in low-income communities. And that was a nonprofit leadership role for a while. And then I got to Georgetown. And when Georgetown asked if I wanted to, help start an entrepreneurship program there, I thought, well, now maybe's the time to get back into academia. And as you mentioned, it's been over 10 years. It's been a wild ride.
Right. What I love about listening to people talk about their stories as to how they get to or got to the seat that they're in today is, first of all, they're not straight lines. but that there's a thread that runs through them. Like there's oftentimes a family of origin thing, and you mentioned that that's true for you. There's also somewhere along the line this interesting opportunity to have people who we may have taught or interacted with as their senior in quotation marks telling us what we might think about we should do next. So part of the reason why I'm even sitting here doing this podcast is a function of a student who said to me, hey, you know what? I do one. You'd probably be okay at doing this. Maybe you should try this. And I was like, you're crazy. Yeah. Why would I do a podcast? Not that I have anything against them. but it was being willing to take that. So when that student said to you, you should go back to teaching, was that something that you were like, yeah, I'm dying to do that?
Well, I thought hard about that. You know, it was a time in my life when I was trying to figure out what to do. And I had loved a lot of pieces of working at a university. And so I thought about, well, what do I like? What do I not like? But that former student telling me, hey, this is what you should do, it did strike me and kind of have an impact and say, okay, maybe he's right. Maybe this is my calling. And being the founder of a program like I was able to do at Georgetown, that was an attractive piece too.
Right.
Not a lot of great universities had not already created a program.
Right.
So being able to start one up at an amazing place like Georgetown, it was a wonderful opportunity. And so but you're right. I learn from my students all the time.
Right. And I think that that's something that, I know a lot of other people who do that, but then I think I know a lot of other people who would sort of say, well, you know, there's nothing. What am I going to learn from someone who knows less than me, in quotation marks? But we all, if we really do the full 360, there are holes in our knowledge that can be filled by people from all around. And I think that that's really important to have that humility.
Yeah, and looking back, you mentioned there can be a thread through people's experience.
Right.
You know, my story, only telling the story in retrospect can the thread be pulled.
Right.
In this case, I've always been around entrepreneurs and education, you know, and for a little while, there was a little bit less education and more about the entrepreneurship side, but it's always been about helping entrepreneurs one way or another. But really, what I do more, what I love doing more, is helping people discover what they're passionate about and go out and find a way to do it.
Right.
That might mean starting a company, but not always.
Right. So, and that actually, that's an interesting point and segue there, because the word entrepreneur and the terms startup, new venture, early stage company, all these things get sort of thrown around. Why entrepreneurs? Like, what is it about entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship that sort of gets you going?
Yeah, there are a few things. You know, one, it's just a fun group of people to be around.
Right.
So if you think about, entrepreneurs are generally going to be creative,
right,
ambitious, solving problems.
Right.
That's all fun. Mm-hmm. There's an idea of, you know, making the pie bigger for everyone instead of, you know, some industries, some careers, you're kind of fighting over your slice of the pie. And that's a different type of mindset, a different type of personality. But I think maybe more than anything, it's the ability for entrepreneurs to create something that is uniquely theirs, that is a fit with them as an individual. I think that's one of the biggest challenges, and I see this all the time at Georgetown and with young people everywhere, not just young people, I'll say, is there's a sense of, how do I figure out my true place in the world?
Right.
And a lot of people accept jobs and choose careers for the wrong reasons. Just,
right.
You know, they haven't figured out what they want to do, or they do it because somebody else told them it was what they should do. Entrepreneurs are generally people who said, you know what, I've figured out what I want to do, and I'm going to go do it. And they're often able to create a company based on their own kind of unique personal characteristics and desires. And I think everyone should try to find a way to make their own impact in the world. It doesn't mean everybody should start a company, but that's essentially what entrepreneurs do. And
right.
People that are around entrepreneurs, you kind of get to see that, hey, I am who I am, the good and the bad, the parts of me that are good, I'm going to use those to my benefit, the parts that are bad. You know, maybe I'm not a kind of guy who can succeed in a desk job or a traditional
right.
kind of career. And in some worlds, that looks like I'm a failure. But I can turn that around and say, oh, maybe I can be really successful in another way.
In another space. So this is another important thing, because I think that And I know that there are folks who listen to this show who are themselves right now in school, and that's their full-time thing. They're in grad school for the most part in a health or public health space. But then there are others who are early career professionals, mid-career professionals. I'm glad that you mentioned it's not just, in quotation marks, young people, right? But it can be anybody, because it is about your curiosity, your passion, and your desire to try to make a particular mark around things that really get you moving and that you are passionate about and interested in. But something that that you did not say, which I'm glad you didn't say, because it's absolutely probably not true, is that all of these folks come from a particular cloth, if you will. So you're not saying, well, you're a business student and you are thinking of X, or you're a policy student and you think. You've got so many different types of people in the innovation hub over there at WeWork, that it blows my mind every time that I've spoken to you about it in the past, and when I was there a few weeks ago. It's just amazing to me how you've got so much diversity with respect to the backgrounds and where people are coming from, sort of educationally. Do you find that certain groups gravitate? Is there a particular group that you know does particularly well, or is that a myth that one particular group of students coming from a particular school is likely to outperform another group coming from another school in this entrepreneurship thing?
Yeah, I can say categorically that there's no one type of person that has to be an entrepreneur, or there's no one group of students that's more entrepreneurial than others necessarily. No one discipline. You know, right. Our program at Georgetown, and I learned this from my time 20 years ago at UNC Chapel Hill, where if you focus just on business students, you lose a ton of talent, a ton of creativity.
Right.
Entrepreneurs come from everywhere.
Right.
You don't need formal education to be a successful entrepreneur.
Right.
There are a lot of things we can teach you to help you be successful, but we teach those to people across the university. They don't have to be business students. Graduate, undergraduate, we have art history majors, med students, law students, as well as MBAs and business undergrads. And, you know, any one of those people that's creative and wants to solve a problem, we can teach them how to go through a process to make themselves more likely to be successful as an entrepreneur.
Okay. So as you talk to these folks and you're trying to get them to sort of pay attention to the lessons you're trying to have them learn, do you find that there are things you have to sort of rein them in and bring them back to a lot of the times? Or are they trying to get to... Are they always trying to rush ahead to something? And what is that something that they tend to be rushing ahead to, and that being a mistake to be rushing ahead to that thing?
Yeah, there's a common conversation we have. If someone enters our system, they come to visit my office, or we get an email, or somehow they kind of show up and they say, hey, I've got this idea. Can you introduce me to venture capitalists?
Ah.
You know, they think that's the path. I have an idea. Next, I need investors. And of course, there's a whole lot of steps in between, and investors may not be what you need to start a successful company
right. In
different ways. And certainly, it's not the first step. So that's one of the things that we teach. Like, okay, how do you validate your idea without spending a lot of money, without needing investors? How do you figure out if this is worth pursuing or not? And then, you know, there's a whole lot of steps along the way from there. But yeah, today's world, it's so much easier to be an entrepreneur than it ever has been.
Okay.
And one of the things you can do is you can create a lot of stuff, a value, product, whatever it might be, to get validation without spending a lot of money.
You know? Now, what is that? Now, it's an interesting point you make about you can get validation from a number of different ways and spaces. Now, so let's take, I think it was Instagram recently started hiding likes. I think that you yourself as the Instagram account holder can see how many likes you might get for a particular post, but people who are followers of yours can't see the likes, because apparently seeing likes might inspire some people to like something, right?
Yeah.
Not because they necessarily liked it, but because, well, it looks like everyone else does. There are new currencies, basically, in influence. What have you noticed over the last 10 years with respect to how things like social media have changed the entrepreneurship game and what people might perceive to be a great idea based on the fact that they got 200 likes for something or 1,000 likes for something?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily encourage someone to quit their day job because they got a bunch of likes on an Instagram post.
No, but yeah,
it is so much easier today than ever before to reach potential customers.
Right.
And social media is a powerful way to do that. Lots of other digital technologies, you know, you used to have to sell face to face or through, you know, especially early on, it was expensive and time consuming and hard. It's still some of those, but it's easier to reach people anywhere in the world. So if you have something unique that you can provide, a product or service, you don't even have to produce the product to post something on Instagram, for instance, here's what I think I might want to do. Who wants to know more? Who wants to sign up? People will maybe you create a landing page where people can give you their email address if they want to learn about the next product launch.
Right.
Or you could even pre-sell. That's the really bold way to do it, is before you've built your product, say, hey, I'm going to be delivering this in a few months. You know,
buy
give me your
now,
credit card number now, you get a discount. I mean, Kickstarter and other things do
right,
that.
Kickstarter, right, I was going
to say. But those are ways to validate that there's a customer out there or a bunch of customers that want what you have before you even have to spend the time of building it.
Yes, yes, yes. The voice you've been hearing is that of Jeff Reed, professor of the practice at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business and founding director of their entrepreneurship initiative. You're listening to the Junctional Thinking podcast on the full service radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. And we were just talking a bit about sort of how much easier it is now to be an entrepreneur than it has been before, and that it doesn't take a particular background or skill set necessarily to be...
Let me clarify. I said it's easier to start a company.
To start a company.
It doesn't mean it's easy to be a successful entrepreneur.
Yeah. Sorry. Thank you for the clarification, because I'm sure some people who might have listened to that last part and said, oh, so let's go. Which isn't necessarily a bad thing to...
Yeah. You can try things. That's right. It's easy to try, and then you figure out what works and iterate.
And also that jump that folks make from, like, I've got a great idea, now I need venture capital. That's sort of the immediate thing. But I think that the big takeaway, particularly for the folks who I know, who I've spoken to about this from the space that I'm most familiar with, which is the sort of public health space, being entrepreneurial does not mean that you're sort of selling your soul to something. And it's really about you following something that you're very passionate about in the first place.
Well, where it should start is not often. Here's another misconception people have: it's that, you know, I have an idea, therefore I'm going to start a company, right?
Right.
And sometimes it does happen that way, but a lot of times it doesn't start with an idea for the solution. It starts with a problem that you run into.
Of course.
And this happens to anybody in any career. You know, you see something that you run into this problem. You think, why hasn't anybody found a solution to this? And if you're curious enough, if it's a big enough problem, you're going to work hard to try to find a solution. If you look around, maybe you hack together something that's not a perfect option. It doesn't solve everything, but it's good enough. You kind of think, why doesn't somebody do this? And then you have to care enough about it yourself. There have to be enough other people who have the same problem and want that same solution.
Right.
But the point I'm trying to make is it starts often with a problem you run into. And people that are in the working world and healthcare or any industry, they kind of run into some problem. They're like, why hasn't somebody solved this? Maybe I have a way I can solve it. And then you kind of go from there.
So let's talk a bit about this sort of problem framing piece. Because one of the issues that we come across, particularly in the health space and in some other similar spaces, is that a health problem can be viewed as being this sort of inanimate quantitative thing. You are diabetic because your blood sugar is this after fasting, and you have these XYZ metrics that make you diabetic. And in order to correct that, there are some things that we need for you to do, right? In an ideal world, we would all go out and do certain diet things, certain physical activity things, and type 2 diabetes, no problem. The issue is life gets in the way, right? And everyone's got different scenarios and issues. The experience of the individual is very different than the data. The data might be the endpoint, but the experiences of a bunch of people with that same data point may be very different. So we talk about the problem, and there's the problem from the quantitative perspective, and then there's the problem from the qualitative perspective, right? Have you, and as people are talking more about things like human-centered design, for example, and making use of that as a methodology, it takes a lot longer to get that type of insight from people than it does to just get a bunch of data about them and mine your way through that. How have you seen that, if at all, impacting entrepreneurs and how they move through their problem-defining phase of things?
Well, one of the very first steps we recommend, and this is all following a process called the Lean Startup,
right.
The Lean Startup method and right. customer discovery, is go talk to customers.
Yes.
If all you do is look at data, if you just do surveys that are impersonal, you don't get the insights you need.
Right.
You have to actually talk to human beings who you think are going to be your customers. There's an amazing program started that's based on this Lean Startup method to get scientists to understand the entrepreneurial process. The program right. is called ICOR, stands for
yes.
Innovation Core,
and yes.
the National Institute of Health, the
yes.
NSF, and you know that.
Yes.
The basically, I've seen scientists who are brilliant. They're
yes.
inventing amazing new technologies and medicines or whatever it might be. They're in university labs and federal labs all over the country. And if they have something they think they want to start a company on, or they think, hey, this is good enough, somebody should start a company on it, they can go through this ICOR program. And one of the first things they do is they have to go talk to the customers.
Right.
And then they have coaches and mentors. They go through this process. And at the end, I've seen them make these presentations, which is absolutely amazing, where these scientists who just look like a prototypical person, an archetype who, you know, the disheveled hair and the maybe even wearing a lab coat, somebody that's like that you don't expect to spend a lot of time talking to humans. They tell you the story about, I thought, you know, these people would care. I had a brilliant idea. I thought this person would want to buy it. And it turns out nobody cares, right? Or but here's what I learned. I learned if
yes.
you frame it this way, or if you understand the human needs.
Right.
And talking to customers, you get this. So that's where that human-centered design is a key part of this. You kind of understand maybe it's a rational decision for a customer to buy your product.
Right.
But you have to figure out who is the right customer, right?
Right.
Maybe it's an organization. You got to figure out who in that organization is the one that is actually got a problem they need you to help them solve. You know?
Right.
So it's a fascinating process, and it can be learned by anyone, no matter what their background, no matter what their current day job is. You can figure it out. It's using the scientific method in a lot of ways.
Right.
It's like, I have a hypothesis. I'm going to run an experiment. I use the data, the results I get to help me make a decision about which way do I go next.
Yeah. And I think, but that's, you do have to have that desire to understand what's behind the numbers.
Oh yeah,
right?
You can't just a common fallacy or mistake people make is they think my idea is great. If they don't listen to customers, they don't listen to what people and the humans they're talking to, and they just think, no, I'm right, everybody else is wrong.
Exactly.
And those are the folks that are more likely to fail.
I've mentioned it before. I call it the yoga mat phenomenon. Sort of like, oh, we've got people are stressed. So what are we going to do? Everyone's got to do yoga. Here, we're going to give everyone a yoga mat. That's what I do for stress reduction. So therefore, it's what you're naturally going to do for stress reduction. Context for, you know, up dog, down dog, etc. Completely forgotten or not even delved into. And it's sort of like, well, why wouldn't they want this,
yeah.
right? And that's
you that talk to them. Maybe they're stressed because they have a family member that's sick, and your yoga's. Yeah, maybe yoga could help in that situation. Maybe not.
Yeah. Right.
Whatever
exactly.
it might be, there might be a problem that you're not identifying.
Not going to exactly because yeah. you haven't taken the time. This is interesting. I sort of want to get into this issue of, and if you'll notice, some of the things that we talked about before, like listening is one of the skills, behaviors, and ideals of junctional thinking, listening effectively and learning how to do that, learning from multiple different sources. There are some unintentional entrepreneurs, right? There's some people who are like, well, weren't necessarily intending to do something, something came up. You talk a bit about people who you might have met who may have had an idea that you were like, you know what, this actually could be something. But they're not thinking that. They're not thinking that that's the thing. Do you try to influence them to sort of try to do something with that? Or is it really got to be about their own desire to make that happen?
And I think my role as a teacher, an educator, and sometimes a mentor, a coach of these aspiring entrepreneurs, it's not to tell them what's good or bad.
Right.
Whatever I might tell them is my opinion.
Right.
And my opinion is worth not a lot. Their opinion's not worth a lot. It's what does the market think? What are their
right.
customers?
So, right.
So, but what I can often do is ask a lot of questions.
Right.
And I do think that I might see a market opportunity, and maybe I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I can help coach them to see the same thing. But if they actually don't believe in it and they don't feel passionate about it, then maybe there's an opportunity for somebody to succeed with that company, but maybe this isn't the right person to do it.
Right.
So the market has to be in the right place. Your product solution idea has to be in the right place, but you as an entrepreneur also have to be in the right place. Maybe it's not the right time in your life. Maybe, you know, right. for some Any reason you're reasons. Not ready to dive in, or maybe it's cool, but it just doesn't strike your passion to go right. after it. So I might see something, but really that entrepreneur has to come to see it themselves too.
Makes sense. Well, we'll be back in a couple of minutes. You've been listening to the Johnsonal Thinking Podcast, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Pierre Vigilance. My guest today, Jeff Reed from Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business, is going to be back with you in just a couple minutes.
The tracks you're listening to during the break are by artist Kiedo, that's K-I-E-D-O. For more information, visit fullserviceradio.org.
Back, and thank you for staying with us or joining us. This is the Junctional Thinking Podcast, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Pierre Vigilance, and my guest today is the founding director of the Georgetown Entrepreneurship Initiative, Jeff Reed. And we've been talking about a few different things, and I want us to get into some really interesting stories, because I've had a chance to meet some of the entrepreneurs in the Innovation Hub and met some and talked to some amazing people in a really, really short period of time, actually. It's a very rich environment with a ton of ideas moving around. But I feel somewhat compelled that today is just towards the end of January. It's the 29th of January. And a couple of days ago, very unfortunately, former LA Laker Kobe Bryant and eight other people, including his daughter Gianna, died in a helicopter crash in California. And it's a very unfortunate and sad situation for his family and their close friends and for the world of sports just in general. But it was really interesting to me. I'm not a huge basketball fan, but it was interesting to me to watch this guy who came straight out of high school, have a 20-year career in the league, and become sort of the OG to a number of other people, become the teacher to a lot of people who came along behind him in other parts in LA and in other parts of the country as well, and in other parts of the world. And his relationship with his daughter and the intersection of sports and parenting, or sports parenting and coaching, sort of makes me to some extent think a little bit about some of the intersections that we deal with in education, right? Because we as educators have to interact with student learners. We learn from them. They teach us things. We try to teach them some stuff too. But it's interesting listening to people talk about him and the things he was getting into, how he was evolving, right? And so in that spirit, if you will, the notion of evolution from the time that someone comes to you with their idea at the beginning to the stages they need to go through and sort of the light bulbs that go on along the way. Kobe had a story, and a particularly fluent one. What are some of the sort of trajectory stories that sort of stand out for you as you think about the people that you've interacted with over the years?
Well, one thing I see a lot, and Kobe is an example of this, is someone who's really, really good at their thing. I mean, he's an exceptional example, right? He was great at basketball. But later in his life, his priorities were family, giving back, right? I see a lot of successful entrepreneurs who maybe they were heads down, focused 100% in their jobs, in their companies for a long time.
Right.
But at some point when they think, okay, I'm in a position where I can spend my time however I want, what do I want to do? It's family and giving back.
Right.
And so I think, you know, we benefit from having folks that want to contribute to our program who mm-hmm. come back as entrepreneurs in residence, as adjunct faculty, mentors, coaches, advisors. It's a huge, huge benefit to our program. And I think any aspiring entrepreneur out there can find people that want to help them. You know, people who have been successful as entrepreneurs want to give back. And,
right.
And there's a strong community in every city of the country and cities all over the world where entrepreneurs love helping the next generation of entrepreneurs.
Right. Okay. And I think that giving back piece is, it's like it's a service to some extent, and it's also a calling to some extent. You have to sort of want to do it. Obviously, you're better at it if you want to do it than if you're not that enthusiastic about it. But you have some folks within the Innovation Hub now who are doing some great things, and actually may get a couple of them to come in and join us on the show as well at some point. But folks who sort of stand out to you, or stories that stand out that you're able to sort of speak to right now.
Yeah, there's one in the public health field that you met, and you're talking about our Georgetown Venture Lab.
Sorry, yes.
Which is located in downtown D.C. It's underwritten by a generous contribution from the Leonsis family. Right. We have 40 alumni-led startups that are housed there that form a community of entrepreneurs. They help each other out, and we provide community and assistance. And
how long has that been there now?
It's almost 2 years old.
Okay.
Yep. And it's full almost immediately.
I mean,
it's
right.
Great.
It's crazy.
And I have loved, you mentioned earlier that entrepreneurs come from all walks. You know, I think 90% of our entrepreneurs there are not graduates of the business school.
Right.
Right. They're from public health and nursing,
yes,
and law school,
yes,
and all that. So, and it's great to see what they're doing. They're solving interesting problems. One is a young man named Mackenzie Copley, and he, as an undergraduate at Georgetown, he volunteered for an organization that would do HIV screening in different parts of D.C. And he saw that they were not able to serve everyone that needed serving. And so he, you know, had a career for a short time as a management consultant, which a lot of our young people think they're supposed to do after they graduate. That was not fulfilling to him. So he started his own business. It's called One Tent Health.
Right.
And it's a nonprofit social impact, social enterprise. He sets up a tent outside of the Safeway or Shoppers and
right.
all kinds of stores, mostly in Southeast D.C.
Right.
And he has hundreds of student volunteers from Georgetown and Howard and Maryland, a lot of local universities. And they show up and volunteer their time to do free HIV screening. And I believe they're now delivering PrEP.
Right.
And so he is helping in ways that the public health system wasn't able to solve these problems, right? Just getting
right.
people tested is the first step to helping them stay clean or take care of themselves.
Absolutely.
He's getting attention now from the World Health Organization, and others are saying what you're doing is so much better than what anybody else has done to solve this problem. We want to help you and take your model
right.
in other places. And he spoke to a group of my students recently, and when they asked him, you know, why is this the problem you are passionate about solving? And his answer, I'll never forget. He basically said, you know, I'm a straight white male with a Georgetown degree. If I waited for a problem that impacted me personally, I might still be waiting.
Wow.
He basically said, I wanted to solve something. This one was in front of me. It wasn't because he had a particular personal story
or connection.
He just said, you know what? I want to do something good for the world.
For this.
And so
right.
that's what he's up to, and it's moving fast.
And he's so driven by this. So he has a temporary tattoo. He counts down. Because he's aiming to...
He wants to rid the district of HIV
by
his 30th birthday.
By his 30th birthday, which is
I think, maybe 3 or 4 years from now. So he has the number
right.
of days.
Number, right.
So every day he writes
he
a new...
Takes the,
he gets the Sharpie out and writes the date.
Takes the number down.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's phenomenal. And I think that to your point about the engagement piece, I mean, when I spoke to him, you know, we had tried things like offering testing at the DMV type thing. And, you know, folks were like, what are you doing? This is madness. And this is a shout out to the HIV AIDS Hepatitis and Sexually Transmitted Disease Administration, a long title, HOSTA, over at the D.C. Department of Health, headed up by Michael Coffin. Back when Dr. Hayter was the director of that particular division, when I was the commissioner here, people were like, "What are you doing? This is madness. What are you? Why are you trying to sit?" So, well, people have to go to the DMV.
Yeah.
And if they want to, they can have this opportunity while they're there. Some people might consider it a bit obtrusive to have a tent outside of Safeway, but you know,
you go to where people
for
are
for HIV testing, but yeah. Going where people are. I mean, yeah. The Girl Scouts do it all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, to a completely different product, I grant you.
Somebody will come in, you know, they'll stop in the tents on their way into the store, and by the time they come out, they can have their results.
Right.
And right. So, yeah, there's plenty of people that, yeah. Anyway, it's helping identify.
And so for those of you out there who are very familiar with HIV, this is not at all to be glib about the you know, how do you deal with people who do show up as positive, and the supports that have to be behind this are significant, and he's definitely thought about and partnered with the appropriate people to have those people in there. I just want to put that out there because I know sometimes it can sound like, oh, you just go test people and, you know,
that's right.
And it's so simple and we're not thinking about these other complicated things. They really are thinking about those complicated issues. Yeah. I'll
tell you another story. We've got a great entrepreneur, a young woman. She graduated a year ago from one of our graduate programs named Shivini Fernando. She suffers from a pulmonary hypertension condition where her blood oxygen level can decrease at any point.
Yep.
And it's she's turned blue and fallen over and was clinically dead more than once. That happened once on campus at Georgetown. And so her blood oxygen level decreases so fast she can't detect it. You know, if you're in the hospital, they can put the pulse oximeter on your finger. Mm-hmm. But in your daily life, you don't have that.
No.
So she has now created a device, which is her business is called OxyWear. It is a wearable pulse ox. A wearable, and it's an earring, so it's stylish.
Nice.
And it detects the blood oxygen level.
And it's a great place to get that reading from. We usually used to put it on fingers when I was in clinical work, but putting it on the earlobe is actually a very good place for it.
And it wirelessly connects to your phone so that if your blood oxygen level decreases dangerously, it can signal your phone, which signals you, but it can also signal medical professionals, 911, your friends, your contact list, whatever you set it for.
This is a wearable that's.
And she's got some intellectual property built around it. Wow. She won more than one of our pitch competitions at Georgetown. She's been in the Halcyon Incubator for social entrepreneurs.
Yes.
She's raising money now. She's building a team. All of this, she's making incredible progress. She's even found success, or at least interest, early interest from high performance athletes and high altitude athletes, like ski teams and swimmers, who also care a lot about blood oxygen levels.
Right.
So she's finding new markets that might potentially help her grow the business.
And that's
she was just trying to stop herself from dying.
From dying. Yeah.
Turns out she's found that there are tens of thousands, if not millions, of people who have similar enough conditions that might be potential customers, and it's taken off.
And others who arguably don't have the conditions that we're talking about, but may benefit from a performance enhancement / training regimen. Another piece of data to put into the algorithm for how is Pierre doing with this training regimen type thing.
That's right. Yeah. Add it to your Fitbit data, right?
And it's funny you mentioned that because, you know, the Apple Watch does but so much. There's this other thing called the Whoop Strap that does certain things that tells you about heart rate variability. Doesn't measure your pulse oxygenation, though. And so that's a really interesting additional piece. And you have a third? Do you have a third? Sort of like,
oh, man, there's so many.
I know there's a ton, but since you're hitting the health ones, it's like you just...
Well, you met Keith Ives.
He's
So he has a background in both the U.S. military, but also in international development.
Right.
And there, if you think about, this one's not in terms of clinical health, but there are programs that the USAID and other aid agencies fund all over the world. Some of them are health related.
Right.
And we as the American people spend millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars trying to solve problems around the world through these efforts. And the organizations, the NGOs who are on the ground doing it, what Keith does is he helps measure the actual impact.
Yes.
So, you know, we spend money, we do something, we think it's going to make an impact, but sometimes we don't know for sure if it was successful. So Keith has a business that is contracted to come and evaluate those programs.
Right.
And a lot of them are public health related.
Right.
And finding real data that you can use to make good decisions about what should we invest in the next round.
Absolutely. And hugely important, because so much of the time, I'll say this for local government anyway, funding will go to programs outcomes may not be necessarily very well measured. And then we'll try to go ahead and put more money into that same program, but we haven't really done a good job of the evaluation. And what I liked about talking to Keith, and his company's called Causal Design.
Causal Design. Yeah.
And I think he's going to be coming on at the end of next month, because I was just intrigued by the notion that he was able to, I mean, I'll put it out there, you know, monetize evaluation. And that's not a surprise to people in that space necessarily that you can do that. But if you talk to most of our students about this and sort of say, you know, this design monitoring and evaluation course that you're doing, do you see a future for yourself doing that to make a living? Most of them will say, well, maybe, but it'll be in concert with some other things. But for it to be a for-profit company doing it and doing it for these other organizations, I think is significant, especially given the fact that it's social impact that they're looking to measure.
Oh yeah.
And there's a new frontier of measurement that he's actually going to be pushing into that's really exciting.
Yeah. It's I just love being around these entrepreneurs who are finding ways to solve problems.
Right.
You know, and some of them are making a good living off of it.
Right.
Others are still scraping by, but they're doing it because they love it.
And right.
Some of them are very likely to be successful.
Absolutely, absolutely. So looking forward in the last sort of couple minutes of the show, so as you just passed this 10-year mark with the innovation, with the entrepreneurship initiative, as you look down the road, what do you see coming with respect to, is it going to continue to be very easy to, or potentially easier to start this? Is it going to get ever easier, or are we going to hit a roadblock, or is there a cliff edge coming? What's going on with entrepreneurship?
One way to think about the future of entrepreneurship is to think about what kind of problems we have in our world.
There are a few.
And there's no shortage of those.
Right.
Some of them are becoming bigger and bigger.
Absolutely.
So the more problems there are, the more opportunities there are for someone to find a solution.
Right.
And entrepreneurship can thrive in an environment where there's constant change. And we see our world, the rate of change is only accelerating. And so as technology's evolved, as populations change and demographic shifts and the climate changes and politics changes and healthcare and education, all these industries are changing. And so, yeah, it can be scary if you're the kind of person that loves stability. But even if you like stability, you need to, my advice would be to learn to deal with ambiguity and change and to think about it with a different lens. It's like, okay, if this big thing is changing, what opportunities will come available?
Right.
And so if you see self-driving cars or artificial intelligence or whatever, you know, smart cities. I mean, there's huge, huge shifts. I mean, it's exciting to think of what our world's going to look like in 10 years and 20 years and the place where my kids will grow up. And,
right.
And yeah, that can be scary to think, okay, I liked the way things are, but there's going to be so many opportunities for entrepreneurs. And the reality is very few of us are going to have a job that's going to last more than a few years. So you need to be willing to change and grow. And maybe you identify as a person who wants to work for some big stable organization. But there's probably a chance at some point in your life, you're going to either be laid off or you're going to see an amazing opportunity. Somebody's going to come to you and say, hey, let's start this thing together. Or maybe it's your own idea. So yeah, I think that the future of entrepreneurship is great because the world is changing so much and we need entrepreneurs. We need people who can find solutions to all these problems and help us make our world better.
There's no shortage of them. True. So change favors entrepreneurship, and a plug actually related to the world of work changing and how that changing world of work means that people who are working now, for example, check out at your local Walmart, has changed significantly in the last few years because you do much more self-checkout.
Fewer clerks.
But
there.
Where are those clerks going, or where what kind of work is it that they can get into so that they can make a living wage for their family? So we've got multiple social, health, civic challenges to deal with, and I think you're right. In a nutshell, change does favor entrepreneurship.
But you pointed out something really important, is that we have to do it in the concept or the context of humanity,
right?
Not just for the sake of making money or whatever else. It's
absolutely.
What can we do to help the world be better for all of
us? See a change and then try to figure out how we all get lifted up by the opportunities.
It's a big part of what we do at Georgetown, is with the values infused there.
Good stuff. Well, look, We have come to the end of our time. This time always flies by very quickly. I very much appreciate you joining me today. You've been listening to the voice of Jeff Reed, who is a professor at Georgetown University, the McDonough School of Business, the founding director of the Georgetown Entrepreneurship Initiative, who, you know, is now 10 years old and continuing to thrive. Thank you very much for joining me today on the show.
This has been great. Thanks so much, Pierre.
Appreciate you. And you've been listening to Junctional Thinking, the podcast broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. And we will see you next time.